time we're going to take a look at something that is difficult to consider, and that is the presence of slaves and the practice of slavery in the Roman Empire and in early Christianity. So first, let's take a look at the empire itself. It was one of what historians call the great slave societies that are known in the world. Almost every culture engages in some form of slavery, of involuntary servitude, and it can be called by all kinds of different names. But very few societies actually had an economic system that depended on it. Ancient Greece was one. Ancient Rome was one. The United States, until less than 200 years ago, was another. So when we consider slavery here, those of you who are watching from the United States, you will find some similarities and other things that are very different. We today want to refer rather to, instead of slaves, to enslaved persons, so that person is the noun, and that's a very good practice when we're looking at the history of American slavery. I may find myself trying to do that and sometimes slipping back into slaves when we're talking about this ancient situation, because in most of the scholarship about this, we do talk about slaves, but you understand the difference, and it's important, because the word slave doesn't grant the personal dignity to the person, the enslaved person. Principal means of acquisition of slaves were war, capture in war, and what's called a verna, singular is verna, which means a house-born slave. A slave who is born into the familia, into the household, and lives his or her whole life there. The word verna ending in A, if you know some Latin, usually that's a feminine form, but in this case it's a masculine word, and the plural is verne, which is the feminine form of the plural, but the word can refer to a man or a woman in that form. In terms of war captives, in Rome was involved in wars for a whole century, at least a century, just before this time, the time of Augustus. And then, of course, you had the Jewish revolt in the first century and the capture of Jerusalem in 70. And that meant a massive number of Jewish slaves who were sent to the slave markets of the Roman Empire. And the Colosseum in Rome was built in the years after that, and there's some speculation that a lot of Jewish war captives, enslaved Jewish war captives, may have actually worked on the building of the Colosseum. It's a speculation, but they certainly needed some extra labor at that time, just right after that. And, I'll say more later. Now, one of the things that's important to know here is that slaves did not look any different from anybody else. There was nothing to do with skin color, and they did not dress differently from ordinary people on the street. You had no way by sight to distinguish an enslaved person from a free person. And There were speculations about how many slaves were actually in any given city. They didn't want to know terribly much because I think they didn't want anybody to realize the large number of enslaved people had there been anything like a slave revolt. Now, there were two or three of them, not in Rome itself, but particularly in the south in Sicily and a couple of other places. They were always brutally put down by the army because they had to be sure that there was complete control. And for everything indicates that there were far more male slaves than female. And that would be because of the capture in war. What happened to the women and children? We don't know. But even in households, waiters at meals, everything indicates a larger number of men than of women that are enslaved. Now, that has implications for demography. It means that the slave population could not replicate itself, and so that it depended on the influx of new enslaved peoples. And you can imagine what that was like for slave owners who needed to continually acquire new slaves, train them, domesticate them. Men who had been warriors, who had been soldiers, now enslaved, are not going to be your best house servants. So all kinds of problems there that arose, and there are indications that free people in households were often afraid of their slaves, because they could be surrounded by enslaved peoples who were supposed to be loyal and obedient to them, but maybe weren't. And people lived in fear of their slave household killing them. And there were examples of that, known examples of that. The other thing is that the enslaved people around them had ears. They could hear everything that was said. They could see everything that went on. And when the authorities would suspect that some kind of a crime had been committed by the householders themselves, the first people they interrogated were the slaves, and they would interrogate them with torture. So you can get a sense of the vulnerability there on both sides. The vulnerability of the enslaved people, of course, whose lives depended on this situation, but also the fear and the vulnerability of the householders. And if they felt they couldn't completely trust their own enslaved people. Now, to give some sense of relative autonomy of the enslaved, this is a funerary inscription that is rather fascinating. It is in the it is in a cemetery on the Via Triumphalis, which ran north on the west side of the Tiber in Rome. Today it's under the parking lot of Vatican City. And it is a cemetery of ordinary people. There are no great mausolea in this cemetery. And in this cemetery is this little monument. And it is put up by a man named Sotricus, who is an imperial slave. He is someone enslaved in the large system of the imperial palace and the imperial administration. And he erects this monument to his contubernalis, which means a common law wife. Her name is Fannia Secunda. And slaves could not contract legal marriages, nor could people of disparate social rank. If, for instance, somebody from a senatorial class wanted to marry a freedwoman, it could not be a matrimonium. It could not be a legal marriage. It would be a contubernalia. So a contubernalis, we translate that as common law, but it didn't have any kind of disparaging sense to it. It's simply what people did according to their social class. So this is an enslaved man, an imperial slave, who has enough money, enough assets, to consecrate a very simple, or rather commemorate, a very simple funerary monument to his wife, Fannia Secunda, who died before him. So you get a sense that, you know, the enslaved were not necessarily in chains all the time or anything. They had a great deal of urban slaves, had a great deal of movement and freedom. The evidence indicates that somewhere around the age of 30, let's say in the 30s, a high number of urban enslaved people gained manumission, which meant that they were now a freedman or a freedwoman. And the way in which they were manumitted, there were a number of ways. One was by the death of their owner in their will, and that quite often when slave owners died, their will specified that their slaves should be freed. And that's a legal manumission. They would then keep a relationship to their owners, their former owners' descendants, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Another way was for their slave owner to simply legally manumit them. There was a legal process for doing that. There were more informal ways of manumission, which weren't always good because it put the freed person into a sort of a middle kind of a category that wasn't clear. There were a good number of freedmen and freedwomen in this society, and the two Firmia people, the couple with the little child that we just saw, they were examples of that. And this population of freedmen and freedwomen were the most upwardly mobile segment of Roman society. They were the ones who had more possibility than anybody else to change their wealth status, to change their achievements. Freedmen themselves were never going to be elected to public office. They could not. But we have ample evidence that in the next generation they could. Sons and grandsons of freedmen were eligible for election to public office. And so you can say that there's a kind of public advancement there that that happened. If you're at all familiar with Latin literature, the Satyricon has a character, Trimalchio, who is a freedman, who is exaggeratedly rich. It's a satire. The whole thing is a satire. And it's a satire written by an elite Roman. But Trimalchio is kind of the example of the freedman who is, he's so wealthy he doesn't know what to do with himself. And he tries to emulate the high education of the elites. And he fails at it because he doesn't really understand, because he's not really well educated. It's a funny kind of thing. But it says something about how the elites, the Roman elites, despised these freedmen who got ahead, who got higher than their social level should have been. You know, they got wealthy, and therefore had some kind of power. Now, Roman freedwomen also had the same kind of upward mobility in terms of marriage, for example. And here is an example of a Roman freedwoman. She's also in the museum in Ravenna. Her name is Pacia Helpis. And she is a freedwoman of Gaius Pacius. And she is married to Marcus Valerius Corvinus. So often, manumission of a woman was what they called matrimonia causa, for in order to marry the person who had been her slaveholder, the man who had owned her. In this case, though, it's different. You kind of expect when you go on to this inscription to find that, but in fact, both her former owner and her husband commemorate her together. So we would love to know what was their relationship, how well they got along with each other. But the two of them contribute to this funerary monument for her. And I should say something here. about what happens in the relationship of a freed person to their former owner. And there are two terms that are used, obsequium and operae. Obsequium means giving honor to. A freed person was expected to be utterly loyal to their former slave owner, now their patron. It's a patronage. It's a case of formal patronage. We're going to talk about patronage later, and both formal and informal. But in this case, it's formal patronage. It's built into law. And so utter loyalty. And when your patron wants you to show up to show how important he is, to have all these people flocking around, you have to do it. That's all part of obsequium. The other is operai, which is to contribute labor for a specified number of days per year. And we don't know how many days. It seems to have been by contract in different ways. So that the freed person could go off and start a business, do things on their own, or contribute a business they may already have had as a slave, and to keep the profits. But there were a certain number of days a year when you had to contribute your labor free to your patron. So there was a continuing relationship between the patron and the freed person. There were many probable freedmen and freedwomen in the New Testament. We don't know for sure, but some that are really good possibilities. Joseph Barsabas Eustace in Acts, they're trying to elect someone to replace Judas, and it's this man or Matthias, and the lot falls on Matthias. And you'll wonder what happened to this poor guy. But the fact that he has two Jewish names and a Latin name is kind of a giveaway, because people in the Eastern Mediterranean, they were Jews or Syrians or something like that, if they had a Latin name, it's quite possible that he was a freedman. Lydia in Acts 16, it's often been pointed out, her name is the name of a place. And so and she is a merchant of purple cloth, and it's a perfect setup for a freedwoman. Who is keeping her own, the name that she was given by her owner. Maybe she didn't have any other personal name. And she's in this little business by herself. Now, one that we know was a freedman is Antonius Claudius Felix. He's just called Felix in Acts 24. And he was the procurator of Judea from 52 to 60 of the first century. And Paul has an audience. Paul, under arrest, has an audience with the governor Felix. That's this person who we know was a Roman freedman. And in Acts 6, it refers to a number of synagogues in Jerusalem, and one of them is the synagogue of the freedmen. Some translations I noticed said the synagogue of the libertini, and that is exactly what it says in the Greek. But libertini are freedmen. It doesn't mean libertines, and one of the translations says the synagogue of the libertines, which maybe that's a good example of how word meanings change, because it's not libertine in the sense of, you know, people who do anything. It's freedmen and freedwomen. So those are some examples of possible freed people. They were all over. Paul himself may have been the son of a freedman and a freedwoman. Jerome, who's several centuries later, says that Paul's parents were from Gishala in Upper Galilee, and that they were enslaved by a Roman, and that they gained their freedom with citizenship. And I should have said something about citizenship. When in most times in the empire, when a slave was freed in the legal way, the slave also became a Roman citizen. So that really extended the sense of the domain of loyalty to Rome, you see, by having these citizens all over the empire. And if Jerome is right, then Paul is the son of a freedman, which is very interesting. And Acts 22 says that Paul was born a Roman citizen, which he would have been, as the son of a freedman who was a Roman citizen. This is in his encounter with soldier, I think it is, who says, I acquired this citizenship with a great price. You know, he bought his citizenship, and Paul says, but I was born with it. So that's an interaction there with slavery. This is another family of freed persons, mother and father. The mother's name is Sempronia Eune, and the father is Servilius Hilarus. And they have a son whose name is Servilius Clausulus. Yeah, this is the same monument from two different perspectives to give you better light. It's in the Gregorio Profano Museum in the Vatican. And just once more, the Firmius family, we have identified in the second from the top rank, we've identified this couple with their little daughter. The woman at the top, her name is Firmia, and she is also a freed woman of the same household. In the third from the top, with the two young men, they have entirely different names, and they are freeborn. And we know that from their inscription. Probably they were adopted children in this household. And at the bottom is, what's his name? Sperato. Yeah, Sperato is a Verna. He is a houseborn slave who died as a child. And so I find this monument really fascinating because none of them are Christians, of course, but it really shows you the kinds of complicated family relationships that could happen, because probably all of these people lived in the same house.